The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy
with Nissan
on News Talk.
You're very welcome back to The Hard Shoulder. Kieran Cuddihy with you until 7 o'clock. And I am delighted to be joined in studio for the Thursday interview this week by Martin Beans Ward. Martin, you're very welcome.
Well, thank you very much. You didn't pronounce the E at the end of Ward.
Oh, sorry, Wardy.
No,
no, there is a story to that E, though, isn't there? Tell me about it.
Well, some people would tell you that, you know, having the E always, it, I don't know, brings more fun, maybe. Wardy, it's actually a weird story. It's not a funny story, but okay, we'll discuss it a little bit. It was actually down to the doctor who signed the birth cert, and it's on my birth cert with an E. It's not on my brother's birth cert. It is on one of the other brothers' birth certs. So because it's on the birth cert, it has to be like that in driver's license, passports, the whole lot. So that's where it came from.
So you have an E at the end of your name because the doctor writing your name,
he was,
put an E on
was,
it.
He was taking a piss, I think. He put a big squiggly thing at the end. But you know, you ever see doctors writing anyway? It's almost like...
Oh, it's indecipherable, yeah.
It's like hieroglyphics, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, I blame that doctor.
And did it cause any difficulties kind of travelling anywhere when you were kids? You know, the there was different names.
Well...
I guess they're close enough.
I mean, travelling with an E doesn't make travelling any more difficult, you know? There's no extra weight attached to it. But I tell you, one of the things that does come up sometimes would be other people with a similar surname ask me, where'd you get that? Or you tried to be a settled person, like, you know. Because, of course, settled people carry E's around their pockets, you know.
So this is the traveller version of people kind of dropping the O to take the soup, maybe.
More or less. We didn't take the soup, though. We took the gates. I'm joking, sure. No, but yeah, it's one of those things. I think they're only joking, really, trying to annoy me, you know.
On the comedy front, though... You're not touring at the moment, is that right?
No, I'm not. I'm focusing on three things at the moment. Four, actually. So I'm mid-flow through my thesis for my Master's in Journalism with UL.
Very good.
And I've just started two projects. One with the National Museum of Ireland, which is cataloguing 10 videos with 10 traveller elders, kind of capturing their words of wisdom and just things from the past that's going to be lost in the next 10 or 20 years. When the elders, you know, pass on, that became something that I felt is very timely, given that our elders die 10 to 15 years younger than their settled neighbours, and there just isn't enough archiving of their stories.
Yeah.
Also, like, we're into the last generation of travellers who actually lived in wagons.
Yeah,
you know, and that's or tents. Like, once they pass away, we're literally left with, you know, our version of what they once told us around the kitchen table or whatever. So
yeah,
this is a very important thing that's happening at the moment, and that's with the National Museum.
Have you started documenting them? I mean,
so
what sort of stories are you hearing?
Going through the research phase now at the moment,
okay.
Which shouldn't take more than another week or so. I have some participants lined up. One of them would be a tinsmith. So I'm going to record a tutorial of how to do that. And ask the practical things like, you know, where do you get the metal? What kind of metal? What kind of hammer? You know, and basically go step by step through the process of, say, making a bucket or whatever. Because that might be invaluable in 20 years' time or 30 years' time. I know that I'd love to learn a little bit about tinsmithing. I'm crap at my hands. Like, I'm useless.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other project is with the Photo Museum of Ireland. That's a new name. It was the Gallery of Photography Ireland. But
okay.
Big up to the name change there recently. Did a big party.
They'll be happy now with the branding.
Of course, of course.
Driven home with you, yeah.
So the project with that is, it's actually in, it was in conjunction with Creative Ireland, the HSE, the Open Doors Initiative and the Gallery of Photography Ireland and myself. So that's kind of a look at how we can talk about mental health and well-being within the traveller community through the lens of, well, literally through the photographic lens.
Mm.
So I'll be meeting each participant, again, 10 participants, although that number might be more or might be less. It all depends on the actual participants. But I'll meet them on day one for a portrait shoot, and then after that, they will be tasked with, I'll send them a message and I'll say, send me a picture of something that made you smile today, something that made you reflect, something that made you proud, or... you know, something that made you want to follow Martin Beans' word on Twitter, at Martin Beans. but you know, so something like that. And the whole point is to get the perspective of the individual. And each individual will be different as well. So people with disabilities, people that might be LGBT, or, you know, the older generation, younger generation. So a good healthy mix. And it's about them filling in the pages between the portrait picture I take at the start and the portrait picture I take at the end. So it's like they're filling out the pages of their chapter, and it's from their perspective.
And when you talk about health and well-being and mental health and well-being of travellers, we were speaking on the show earlier at the Mental Health Commission, a big report out today looking at various different issues. And I'm conscious that of all the shortcomings they highlight, you know, that those shortcomings are compounded, or they're more acute in the travelling community,
aren't
they?
There's nothing cute about it, so here, I tell you. But they are, you're right, it is definitely magnified and intensified, but that's not unusual, actually, for a marginalised group anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
The travelling community are 6 to 7 times more likely to take their own lives. And I think Limerick is the worst hotspot for suicide in the country, and I think the vast majority of those will be travellers also. It happens quite regularly. We lost 2 members of the community, 2 children, in the last number of months. This year alone, I think we're up to 20. Like, it's crazy. It's happening. Yeah. And then, of course, there are the suicides that are noted as death by misadventure, because there's a stigma attached to talking about suicide or, you know, poor mental health. So sometimes the family... And that doesn't come back to travel tradition. And just to clarify that, that actually goes back to old Catholic Ireland, where at one point in the past, you weren't allowed to be buried in the graveyard if you took your own life.
And I know, I remember speaking to a former coroner in Kilkenny years ago, and he would have said, like, you know, again, years previous to that, he would have come under real pressure from people. You know what I mean? Do not find this as a suicide. And I'm sure that still exists, I think, probably right across society to a degree. But again, is that something else that, while it's not of the traveller tradition, it's born of kind of Catholic Irish tradition, is that still more magnified in the travelling community?
There's
still more of a likelihood that you don't want it to be classed as suicide?
I think so. Yeah. I think there's... Well, look, let's not discount either the horrible circumstances that non-travellers go through in similar situations, because while travellers... are a microcosm of Irish society, there are other pockets within Irish society that would be quite traditional also, like, you know, the Gaelgors or the Islanders, or, you know, even the farming community. So they feel it too. And of course, then you have the LGBT community.
And even generations with it, different generations within society would have different views.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Of course. And I think what's healthy at the moment is people are talking about, you know, either being anxious or depressed, and they're more willing to speak about it. But you're inevitably going to find that there are certain groups of people, usually, you're right, the older generation, who just won't talk about it. And that's quite sad to think that the older generation, because by and large, once you get to a certain age, you tend to be forgotten about. If you're suffering from poor mental health and you're in your 50s, people are like, oh, get on with it. You know, everything is geared towards the youth, which is great. It's fantastic. But I don't think it should be at a cost of forgetting about people after a certain age.
Yeah.
Because life can be quite daunting, especially coming through the pandemic. I mean, there is no way that Irish society hasn't felt the pinch of anxiety or depression after the pandemic or throughout the pandemic. Saying goodbye to relatives through a window pane, not being able to hold their hand as you're watching your elderly relative fade away, and they're absolutely terrified with terror in their eyes, knowing that they're about to leave this world without having a family hold their hand. And that's nothing to do with ethnicity. That's to do with society. And I think when you break it down to that, we all come to the table with different issues, but they all inevitably end up in the same way. And that's poor mental health. And I think that's it. It needs to be talked about more. It needs to be destigmatized more. But also that older generation need to be remembered more.
Yeah, you wonder, like, when you think of that older generation, how many people we can think of who had periods where they, you know, took to the bed or whatever, however it was, whatever euphemism was described for periods, and they were just going through really acute depression, but there was just no help for them, and how different their lives might have been had there been help for them. When you say destigmatise...
Sylvia Plath actually have a poem about a woman who was put to the attic.
Does she? Okay,
I think so. I'm nearly sure. I'm sure somebody listening now like, that fella to shut up. It's not Sylvia Plath. I don't know. I think it is. There was somebody who had, and it was about kind of, one of the things was, she was put into the attic because she took to the bed, yeah, or, you know, her nerves are at her, and she was left there, and all she had was the changing shapes of the wallpaper. And I mean, that's quite indicative of what it's like being isolated during the pandemic. Can you imagine then the loneliness, which already rural elderly people already feel lonely? And I mean, that's well known. But can you imagine that then when you're isolated and you can't even go to the shop? Or
Do you want to hear a Sylvia Plath story that's kind of fascinating, but it's quite grim as a story? But
I mean, it wouldn't be Sylvia Plath if it wasn't.
So Sylvia Plath took her own life by putting her head in the oven, and it was house gas was the type of gas that was used at the time that was kind of pumped around houses in Britain, and there was no smell of it. That's why people took their lives that way. It was you could do it.
Before they added the scent.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
And then after the scent was added, the suicide rate plummeted. Absolutely plummeted.
Really?
Yeah. So there was kind of, and the argument is that there's a, you have to, for it to happen, there needs to be a combination of kind of the means and the desire. And once the means was taken away, it just showed that, like, you know, that this idea, I suppose, that some people might say, and you'd hear them shrug it off, well, sure, they were always going to do that sooner or later. You say, well, no, yeah, actually, no. And there's scientific evidence to prove it,
yeah,
that once you remove the means, actually, there's a strong argument to be said then the desire will ebb and flow, and with the right intervention, it can be prevented. But yes, yeah, so
even beyond the means,
yeah,
if you remove the moment where they're forced to think about,
yes,
the act. I mean, adding the scent to gas, when you smell the gas, you're conscious of the gas. If there's no smell there, you're not conscious of it.
Yeah.
You're going to keep breathing. So I imagine it's not even so much about the need or the means.
Yeah.
Although that is definitely relevant when we talk about guns and things like that.
Yeah.
But I suppose that moment where you're forced into thinking and a little bit, yeah, of extra introspection. And sometimes that's what they say, you know, that one conversation with somebody may make them think about what they're about to do and may give them some clarity.
Yeah, yeah, what backs up that theory, if we'll call it that as well, is that, you know, people who like taxi watch and these services that exist in this country whereby they'll keep an eye out for people maybe in distress at night. You know, people on certain bridges, well-known spots where people might kind of throw themselves into the water, where they do intervene successfully. The people they intervene with,
they don't get funded either, by the way.
Yeah, but
there's those guys like up on the Shannon River in Limerick, up along the river there in Galway. You see them at the bridges the whole time. They'd be there 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And
off their own bat.
Yeah, off their own bat, yeah.
Yeah, but the people they intervene with anyway, like as in, that single moment of intervention, you know, it doesn't delay the inevitable. It actually changes the life story.
Changes
completely.
The whole course.
So you're busy then, I take it.
Yes, I'm very busy. I'm very busy. I'm also doing my work in progress for my first theatre show, which I started writing this theatre show after I lost all my shows in the pandemic. I'm like, all my comedy shows gone, wiped out, taken away, you know, forget about it. And I always had an interest in writing, and I started writing for the Irish Times. Actually, it was the Dublin Inquirer first, and then the Irish Times, and then the Irish Examiner. But I always had this interest of kind of delving more into the arts and writing more. And I got in touch with Willie White from the Dublin Theatre Festival, who's been a massive help, actually. Mm. Big up Willie White there.
Yeah.
He's got a bad dose of the Rona at the moment.
Oh, God, yeah. So be at home listening to this in isolation.
We're thinking of you, Willie. but we then kind of thought about, what's the process? So I applied for a theatre bursary with the Arts Council of Ireland, and I was successful, much to my surprise.
Mm.
And I'm sure it's their surprise as well. But it was because of that, and I got the time and space then to actually delve into it and develop, and I wrote my first play. And after I wrote my first play, I performed it for the Dublin Theatre Festival as a work in progress. And then after that, I actually went and watched my first ever play. So I did all of that before actually seeing a play.
Before seeing any play?
Before seeing any play. And my first play was Mark O'Halloran's Conversations After Sex.
Right.
And the opening scene was a man and a woman stark naked. And I'm like,
that's a good way to start.
I'm not doing that. Yeah, that's not going to go down too well with my play. So then I continued to develop it. And recently I did a work in progress at the Listowel Writers Week. And I have the same work in progress is coming up at the Hawkswell Theatre for Traveller Pride Week on July 18th, which is already sold out.
Actually. Okay. What can you tell us about the play?
It's brilliant. So it's basically the story of...
There's no gratuitous nudity early on.
No, there might be not a nipple slip, but that's not intentional. That's just me moving normally, you know.
Janet Jackson moment.
Yeah. it's just these baps are so big, you know. If I have to sit down so I can just rest them on my kneecaps type of thing, you know. So it's the return home of this traveller man who's been in self-exile for over 10 years. And he's home for the funeral of his grandfather. And it starts with him outside what is commonly known as the dead house, where they used to lay the body out inside the house rather than the funeral home.
Mm.
And he's kind of looking on. He's very much outside of his family, but down to his own choosing.
Mm.
And he's kind of looking down at, you know, the crying and all the little traditional things that they do at funerals. And it starts off, you know, he's talking about this is a traveller funeral, basically. But when you're watching it and listening to it, it's no different than any other funeral. And that was the message I wanted to kind of convey with that part of the play, was that when we die, we all die the same way and we all lie in the similar clay, you know. And that's, it's a great leveller, actually. And I wanted to explore that. But then
you're
throughout...
a last poor Yorick moment, is it?
That's the artistic side of me, you know. and then we move on and we find out why the character has, you know, such a dim view of death and funerals. It's because he's actually traumatised from a suicide that happened 15 years prior to that, and he has never recovered. And we go on that journey. So there's almost two parts of the play.
Mm.
And we go on that journey as we find out why. It's love lost. So it deals with suicide, LGBT issues, and my lovely baps on my kneecaps.
Is it how have you found the process of writing for the stage? You write for the stage yourself, but writing a play as opposed to writing a gig?
Okay, well, funny enough, my last tour was called The Gomi Fiend, which had no script. It was 2 hours of ad-lib and improv that changed depending on the audience. And anyone that went to that will tell you that my joke-to-laugh ratio was in around 8 to 10 seconds. So every 8 to 10 seconds there was a laugh because there was an interaction with somebody in the crowd.
Yeah.
But that wasn't going to fly very well with other promoters. So the next comedy tour I have coming out is called Queen of the Travellers, which is kind of a play on King of the Travellers, that big, you know, toxic masculine, let's go box the ears off each other. And there I am in all my fabulousness, you know, so it's more the Queen of the Travellers.
But that's a written play.
That'll be a written show. Yeah. Because, well, I suppose, look, the way it is, you know, promoters need to know what they're getting as well.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, and look, I'm well able to write it, but I had more fun doing the improv stuff. It just, you're more in the moment. And I tend to do better having a bit of banter and a bit of crack.
Yeah.
And that's a real Galway thing, actually. You know, actually, it's a real Irish thing. It's like slagging the heads off each other.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy that. And audiences, by and large, really enjoyed it also.
I'd imagine is it a little terrifying?
Oh, of course it is. And here's the funny thing, right? I actually suffer from, well, mildly now, but I used to be really bad with anxiety.
Okay.
And that stems back to the time my cousin drowned in the swimming pool and I took her out. I was 14 years of age and I took her out in my arms and she was dead. And I had anxiety for years after that. And I learned to cope with it, and now it's diminished to nothing. And all I get now is this anticipatory anxiety. So before I go on the stage, which is quite normal.
Which is normal. Anyone gets it.
Well, anyone that doesn't, like, there's something wrong with them.
Yeah.
They're going to have a really bad gig, because I think you need it, actually. You need to be a little bit on edge as if you're going into battle, because essentially you're on stage to make people laugh. They've paid to see you and for you to make them laugh. So there is an expectation. So if you're not on edge, you're not really respecting the venue and you're not respecting the audience.
Mm.
But that moment before, you'd be absolutely hacking it. I wouldn't eat. I never eat before a show. I can't. Because I find that as soon as I eat, I start to relax and I get that carb hit and I want to go for a nap. And then I wake up and I'm thinking, shite, it wasn't a dream. I'm actually performing in 20 minutes. So I don't eat and I keep myself on edge. And then the second I come off stage, it's like, I deflate and I just drop and I'm like, oh. And actually, here's the funny thing. Anyone that's ever gigged with me will tell you the same thing. I've never come off stage and said, that was a great gig. I've always come off stage and said, oh, shite.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Just self-doubt?
Yeah, I could have done better. These people come out to see you. And it is self-doubt. And I actually think it's to do with the drop of the chemicals, the drop of the adrenaline and the anticlimax. You're coming off stage and your body's kind of coming back to normal and it's saying, what? where you think, and, you know, get out of here quick. People might ask for their money back that you've already spent, by the way, in that lovely new suit that you're wearing, you know. So,
But that's kind of sad in a way that you don't get the...
Don't be feeling sorry for me, Kieran.
But you don't get the kind of... You don't get the kick out of it afterwards for all of the work that went into it.
No, I do.
Or do you get the kick during it, or it's more...
I get a massive kick from the second... You see, the anticipatory anxiety only lasts until you're actually in the moment you're anxious about. So as soon as I pick up that microphone, anxiety's gone, adrenaline kicks in. Inevitably, you're going
to... So it's a real-time kick,
yeah, of course it is. But you're going to have that crash. I mean, if you're on high adrenaline for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and the second you come off, also I sweat buckets. And look at the size of me. I got loads of buckets of sweat. So as soon as I come off, and yeah, I know you're laughing, you're looking at me there, but I can move a lot on stage, right? And I'm high energy. But when you come off, you're obviously going to have that moment where it's like, oh...
Yeah.
And then an hour later, I'm like, okay, it wasn't as bad. And then when you get, you know, you always get the people waiting for pictures and they tell you then. And once you see that positive reaction, then you know that, like, it's not about me, it's about them. I have this thing, it's not even self-doubt. It's doubt that I'm giving the audience what they've paid for. Because I'd hate to be one of those comedians, and they exist, that just want to hike up the price of the tickets, do one gig and not think about how the audience have taken that.
Yeah.
Like I want to keep my audience, I want to grow my audience, but I also want to show them the respect that they showed me while I was building that audience, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm sure that audience looking forward to you being back on the road, gigging that way next year. Where did you say people can check out the work in progress, the play in progress?
Well, unfortunately, the next one is sold out. In the Hawkswell,
so
in Sligo. But... Look, check out my Twitter. I'm looking to put on some dates. It is a work in progress at the minute. It comes in at around 50, 55 minutes.
So there's still a possibility you could start with the nudity.
I don't. I mean, look, if ticket sales are low, is all I'm saying, right? If ticket sales are low,
All right. Well, listen, Martin, it's been an absolute pleasure and thanks a million for popping in.
Thank you for having me, Kieran.
That's our lot for the Hired Shoulder today. Thank you to everybody who tuned in over the last 3 hours. And thank you to the production team, as always, to Kathleen Keane, to Carlo Sullivan, to Alex Russo, D. King and Ronan Coveney were the producers. Michael Quilligan and Peter Malloy were on sound. Off the Ball are up next. I won't be back tomorrow at 4. I won't be back for the next week because I am on my holidays. The forecast is absolutely miserable, so I'll be shriveled up to a prune in the hotel swimming pool, I suspect, by this time tomorrow. But do not worry, you will be in safe hands. The Hard Shoulder, as always, will be with you from 4.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With Nissan.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.